You're listening to On Subrogation, the litigation podcast about how to recover your damages from the people who caused them. We are your hosts. I'm Rebecca Wright.
And I'm Steve Elsif, and we are both experienced civil litigators and partners at Rathbone Group.
As you listen to our podcast, if you have questions or comments, please email us at podcast@rathbonegroup.com.
Or you can visit our website, www.rathbonegroup.com.
Hey, Steve, you're a parent.
I am, yes.
And I'm a parent, too. So does that mean that we're liable for everything that our kids do?
Not everything.
I mean, in the court of public opinion, I think absolutely. But
yeah, if you ask me, I'm responsible, at least.
That's right. But the fact is that, contrary to popular belief, parental liability as a general concept is not a given under the law.
That's true.
It actually depends on the state. Each state handles parental liability differently, and each state attaches liability for a parent differently depending on what the act in question is, depending on the age of the child. Some have different caps and limits on how much the parent can be liable. And so that's what we're going to get into today.
So what we're talking about is parental liability, and it refers to a parent's obligation to pay for damage that's caused by negligent or intentional or criminal acts committed by the child. And this is going to be different from state to state. And from state to state, it differs by age. So each state will have different limits on what constitutes the age of majority for a parent's child and what constitutes damage that a parent is going to be liable for.
That's right. So you mentioned intentional willful acts, and that's often where we see the differences in the age come into play, because we have something in the law called the Rule of Sevens. So the Rule of Sevens is a sort of an old concept, and it really has to do with the capacity of the minor to be liable for their wrongful acts. So the Rule of Sevens essentially states that under the age of seven, the minor does not have any capacity for liability. We don't really expect to charge a baby with a crime. They don't really understand that what they did was wrong necessarily. From the ages of 7 to 14, there's a rebuttable presumption of no capacity for liability. So unless you can prove that this is a particularly precocious minor or that the act was something that they absolutely should have known would cause trouble or something like that, they are not going to be liable.
So how do you feel about that distinction of under 7 doesn't know what an intentional vandalism act is? Because I have a 6-year-old and he knows.
I have a 3-year-old and he for sure knows. But then again,
if he's like intentionally destroying something, he knows that if I catch him, he's probably not going to get out of that one scot-free. Like it's, I don't know. I think he has a good idea of what's cool and what's not cool to do.
I mean, we are talking about a concept that has been around since the 1800s and earlier in the common law, and I absolutely agree. Although, it's my understanding that those kids were already working.
That's what I was going to say. That makes that makes even less sense because, yeah, those in the 1850s, kids were already mining coal.
Right.
So they can go in the coal mine, but they can't write on the side of someone's house. All right.
I think part of it is the distastefulness of it, that we don't really want to see prosecutors prosecuting 6-year-olds. They're very cute.
Or holding them liable monetarily for damage that they cause.
Like, exactly. Especially since they typically don't have any earning potential these days.
Uh-huh. Get a job, Timmy.
All right, so under 7, there's no capacity for liability. And from 7 to 14 years of age, a rebuttable presumption of no capacity for liability. So a child could be liable, but you would have to have proof, and the person who's trying to attach liability has to prove that the child has the capacity for liability. So then once they hit 14 years of age, between 14 and 21 years of age, there's a rebuttable presumption of the capacity for liability. So it's the presumption switches to assume that at that point, the person is old enough that they would understand and mature enough to understand what they have done, what the ramifications are, and to be liable for them.
And just to be clear, this is liability on behalf of the child, not the parent that we're discussing right now.
Exactly. But if the child doesn't have any liability, then typically the parent doesn't have any liability either. Mm-hmm. So although this is adapted from the English common law, it's actually applied in many different legal concepts here in the United States. So most often we see this in criminal cases, whether, like we were talking about, whether a prosecutor is going to actually prosecute a child of this age. Also, we see this applied when we are looking at witnesses. So I had a case years ago where a tortfeasor backed a truck up into her ex-husband's above-ground pool and actually pierced the liner with the hitch on the back of the pickup truck. And the only witness to this, besides the tortfeasor, was the daughter that they shared custody of. And the daughter was 7 years old. She was a very precocious 7 year old. And so I actually did do a sort of deposition to see if I thought that she would be a good witness. And then I would have had to argue the fact that she was competent to testify as a witness. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, after speaking with her and recording that testimony from her, the other side decided to settle that.
So she sounded like she could relay the facts as she had seen them.
Well, there's something to be said for a 7-year-old who sits there and says, oh, yes, mommy did back the truck up into the pool and then told me not to say anything about it. Out of the mouths of babes.
That's dynamite.
So the rule of sevens is not a hard and fast rule in any state. This is more of a concept as it applies to parental liability for subrogation cases that we are going to talk about. Often when we're talking about willful acts, then what we are talking about is vandalism, theft, arson, those kind of things. Things that a child might do intentionally that would result in damage.
Mm-hmm. And the public policy behind this would be that the innocent victim shouldn't have to bear a financial burden that results from someone else's wrongdoing, even if that someone else is a child or is not an adult. There's a difference, I think, between what you would call a child and an adult. And if you're, you know, in that 15, 16 year old age where you commit a lot of acts of vandalism as part of your maturing process, whether or not that child is going to be able to compensate the person that they've wronged if they cause damage depends on the state.
Well, that's absolutely right. And so I actually had a case where this was a big issue a few years ago. It was in West Virginia, and it was a case where our insured's shed on the back of their property had been burned down. Mm-hmm. A 15-year-old from the local high school had come over to the shed after school and burned it down. And so here was the issue. In West Virginia, there is parental liability for willful injury to another person's property, and that includes arson. There is no parental liability for negligent acts. So by the time we got to the lawsuit, this 15-year-old, whether to save his own skin or because he was this savvy, had changed his story and was talking about the fact that he accidentally burned down the shed. He was smoking and he lit the cigarette and he didn't put it out properly and it accidentally caught some leaves on fire.
So this 15-year-old is a jailhouse lawyer?
Apparently. I was quite impressed. I mean, it's entirely possible that it was an unintentional defense, but in West Virginia, it was a very good one.
Uh-huh.
So then the problem that we had was, can we prove that this was an intentional act? And we actually were able to use social media to find his friends who said, oh, yeah, he told us ahead of time that he was going there to burn down the shed. So that's pretty good evidence of intent.
We'll leave it to a 15-year-old to foil himself on social media.
Of course. Now, in that case, There was a limit that we were subject to as well. So for many states, their willful acts parental liability statutes do contain a limits cap. So in West Virginia, for example, we are limited to $5,000. So even if that shed was burned down and it cost, you know, $20,000, the best that we can get from the parents is $5,000. Mm-hmm. Now, if this 15-year-old had a job, theoretically, you could get the full judgment against him, but you can't get more than $5,000 from the parents.
Mm-hmm. So Ohio also has a willful acts statute that has a damages cap. Actually, they have several. The first is that there is joint and several liability imposed on parents for a child's acts of vandalism, desecration, or ethnic intimidation.
Ethnic intimidation.
Ethnic intimidation. And because those are so serious, the damages cap is actually the highest. That's $15,000 damages cap for the parents, plus attorney's fees. Reasonable attorney's fees can be awarded in cases where your child, and in Ohio, that's under 18, so 17 and under, if they can be found to have ethnically intimidated someone or done vandalism or desecration, the parents can be liable up to $15,000 and have to pay those attorney's fees.
Ohio is taking those hate crimes seriously.
That's true. Also, there is liability in Ohio on parents when a child willfully and maliciously assaults a person with force likely to produce great harm. And that one is capped at $10,000 plus court costs.
And that's really interesting because in most of the states that we're talking about where there is a willful act statute for parental liability at all, most of them are only for property damage. So it's interesting that Ohio also has this willful assault statute that provides for a damages order against the parents.
And last but not least, there is liability imposed on parents when a child willfully damages property. And that one is also capped at $10,000 plus costs.
Kentucky, Texas, Massachusetts also have willful damage to property parental liability statutes with various damages caps on them. In Kentucky, the willful marking upon defacing or damaging of any property, so that's like vandalism and arson, has a cap of $2,500 per victim or $10,000 aggregate per parent. Texas has a statute that provides for a damages cap at $25,000, but that is only for willful and malicious conduct of a 10 to 18-year-old. So it's sort of a modification of the rule of sevens there. But 10 to 18, that gets us sort of up into where we have that rebuttable presumption of a capacity for liability. Massachusetts also has a willful acts parental liability statute that has a damages cap of $5,000. Their statute is based on willful acts of children aged 7 to 18 years old. So again, a modification on the rule of sevens in Massachusetts.
And another one that I thought was interesting was New Jersey. They define a child as a minor under 18, and there's a cap of $5,000, but it's only imposed on parents when a child willfully or maliciously causes damage to a railroad, public utility, street railway, or traction railway. And there's also liability imposed on parents when a child damages school property, and that one doesn't make a distinction as far as willful or negligent. But I thought that was interesting that they would limit all this to railroads, public utilities, and school property, and then only cap it at $5,000.
Yeah, it's only for like government entities, public works, and public utilities and things.
Yeah, I imagine the public policy there is just to limit the damage to the most amount of people. The greater number of people would be inconvenienced if a child, you know, damages a railway or a public utility.
What a bright and sunny way to look at legislative intent.
I suppose, but I mean, I don't know what $5,000 is going to cover if, you know, say a train is derailed.
That's true.
It's not going to do much.
I imagine it has something to do with the relation to what actually caused the damage. I'm imagining kids putting pennies on railroad tracks.
Yeah, I mean, it's not willfully damaging the railroad track, I wouldn't think, but
it's a willful act, and it results in damage. So.
So you're not picturing a handlebar mustache child tying someone to a railway.
But what we're talking about right now are willful acts and parental liability as a function of agency, right? Sort of a vicarious liability concept.
Yes, the parent is liable just by virtue of the fact that this is his child or his or her child out there doing damage to people. So this is strictly vicarious liability. The other theories that kind of go along with vicarious liability as far as parental liability is concerned are agency theory, where the child commits a wrongful act while following directions from his parent. Then the parent would be vicariously liable. Or if it was just something the child is doing for the benefit of the parent, like, hey, go out and get milk. And the kid goes out, and while he's on this task from his parent, he causes damage to someone. The parent would be vicariously liable for the damage caused by his agent in that circumstance.
Right, and that's not actually dependent on the parent-child relationship. That's just regular agency law. And so,
it would work if someone told me to go get the milk and I caused damage on my way. So.
Exactly. So it's another way that you could potentially get a judgment against a parent for these damages by that agency liability. We also have several states that have sponsorship statutes. Now, sponsorship statutes are statutes that make a parent liable merely by the virtue of the fact that they signed the minor's driver's license application. So the parent here is vicariously liable for the negligent acts of the minor if they were the one who signed the driver's license application.
And we have that in Ohio, actually. There's joint and several liability imposed on parents who sign the application for the license or permit when the child commits a negligent or willful act in the operation of a motor vehicle and causes injury to another person. And unlike the statutes we mentioned in Ohio earlier, this one does not have a cap. This is unlimited.
That's right. And that's a difference between sponsorship statutes and willful act or vandalism statutes in many states, is that the sponsorship statutes oftentimes do not have any sort of monetary limit. Wisconsin also has a sponsorship statute that states that the parent who signed the license is jointly and severally liable for the child's misconduct in operating a motor vehicle. Now, of course, the sponsorship statutes are limited to motor vehicle collisions just by nature of the type of liability. Kentucky similarly has a sponsorship statute, as does California. And I think that California is a really interesting one because California ascribes a civil liability onto the parent of a minor if the parent or really anyone was the person who signed the driver's license application. And they trump this by agency. So if the minor was acting as an agent for somebody else, like the situation you were talking about before, then the sponsorship statute does not apply. So let's say that mom and dad are split up and mom is the one who signed for the minor's driver's license application. Dad asks the minor to run out and buy something for dad's personal use. Let's say, go buy me a gallon of milk, like you said. And the minor gets into an accident. Under the California laws, the agency situation between the father and the minor would actually trump the sponsorship statute that would otherwise hold the mother liable. So because the child is acting as an agent for somebody else, then the mother as the sponsor would no longer be liable. And primarily this is for business capacities. So if the child is out delivering pizzas or something like that. Interestingly, California and Ohio and several other states have sort of a get out of liability exception to this as well, that the parent can get out of liability via the sponsorship statute by having the minor's driver's license canceled. In other words, if the parent determines that the minor is just a terrible driver or has a propensity for recklessness, then the parent can actually apply to the Department of Motor Vehicles and have the driver's license of the minor canceled. Then there's no more sponsorship liability for the parent. And consequently, also the minor cannot get another driver's license until he or she finds a new sponsor to sign for the application. Unlike some of the other states that we were talking about, California does also cap the liability under the sponsorship statute. It's a $15,000 individual cap and $30,000 aggregate for injuries and only a $5,000 cap for property damage under the sponsorship statutes.
I wonder how many people know about the sponsorship statute in as much as how many people know that they can just call the DMV and cancel their kid's license.
Right.
I think that would be something you would hear about more often, but I've never heard of anyone doing it.
I haven't either. And I think that it would be an important public service to get the word out about sponsorship statutes in general, just so that parents maybe try to be a little bit more careful about when they allow their children to drive. You know, I know there's a lot of movement right now about states writing new statutes whereby kids with learner's permits can't have other children in the car with them, other folks under the age of 18. We're in a texting and driving kind of world now. And so it would be good to make people aware of their potential liability and maybe they'll look after this a little bit more.
I think we should be able to cancel their license by text message.
While driving. In addition to sponsorship statutes, there are other vicarious liability statutes, like statutes that render an individual liable just by virtue of furnishing a vehicle to a minor.
And one of those is called the Family Car Doctrine. Family Car Doctrine will hold the owner of the family car legally responsible for any damage that's caused by a family member when driving. And of course, that's implicated when a child is driving the family car. And this is if the owner knew and consented to the family member's use of the car. And this is applied by about half of the states, and it's under the broader theory of negligent entrustment. So even if the parent doesn't have a minor household member listed on the insurance policy under the Family Car Doctrine, the adult remains liable.
And the Family Car Doctrine is actually not limited to minors either.
Right.
The elements of the Family Car Doctrine are that the head of the household must own, provide, or maintain an automobile for the purpose of providing pleasure or comfort for his or her family, that the family purpose driver must have been using the motor vehicle at the time of the injury in furtherance of that purpose, that the owner knew of and provided either expressed or implied consent to the household member's use of the car, and that the family purpose driver must be a member of the owner's household or, in some states, merely under the immediate direction of the head of household. And what I think is interesting about that last point is there have actually been cases where the court found that a boarder in the house constituted a member of the household such that the family purpose doctrine applied and the head of the household became liable for the negligent driving of that boarder. So we see the family purpose doctrine in a number of different states. Kentucky has a family purpose doctrine. Arizona has a family purpose doctrine that is limited to parents and children. Colorado has a family car doctrine, as does Connecticut, which has a more expanded family purpose doctrine. That one is the one that broadens the definition of a member of the household. New Jersey actually rejects this doctrine, as do others. For example, there was a 1997 case in New Jersey where a father bought a car, gave it to his son for transportation to and from school, and the court found that this furnishing of the vehicle did not create any sort of agency relationship between the father and the son. So even though that would fit squarely within a family purpose doctrine in any of the family purpose jurisdictions, New Jersey rejected it. In addition to the family purpose doctrine, we also have straight furnishing vehicles to minors doctrines. Kentucky has a statute like this. In Kentucky, any adult over the age of 18 who provides a vehicle to a minor and allows the minor to drive it is jointly and severally liable for any damage caused by the minor's negligent operation of that vehicle. It does not matter whether or not that person was the minor's parent. Really, there are no other requirements, just that the person who owned the vehicle was over the age of 18 and that they furnished the vehicle to the minor who was under the age of 18. And what's really interesting is how we can have these different statutes play into each other. So if you have a subrogation case where the opposing driver is a minor, your alarm bell should start going off, that there are many different avenues for recovery there. So when I see a Kentucky case with a minor driver, I start looking at all of these different things. I want to know who was the owner, who signed the driver's license application, who is the custodial parent, because we can get liability joint and severally on all of those people. Mm-hmm. So let's say that you have a minor driver in Kentucky who has parents who are divorced, right? And so let's say that mom is the custodial parent and dad is the one who signed the driver's license application and Uncle Joe is the one who provided the vehicle to the minor. Well, we would actually file a lawsuit against all four of those individuals, the minor, the mom as the custodial parent, the dad as the sponsor, and Uncle Joe as the person who furnished the motor vehicle to the minor, and potentially they would all have liability there. So when we talk about family purpose doctrine and furnishing vehicles doctrines, it's important to note that owners can't be willfully ignorant in order to avoid liability, but there are some ways to sort of work around this. Automobiles that are purchased for and used for commercial purposes may or may not fall under the family purpose doctrine. That sort of depends on the jurisdiction. You know, the doctrine requires that the vehicle be provided for the pleasure and comfort of the family. So does a business vehicle really operate for the pleasure and comfort of the family? Some jurisdictions say yes and some say no. If a vehicle is used for a business purpose and also for a family purpose, then it is more likely to fall under the doctrine. Insurance carriers often try to avoid application of the family purpose doctrine by requiring policyholders to disclose the ages of all of the members of the household, and then the policy may list teenagers as excluded drivers under the parent's policy. That may apply to mean that there's no coverage, but it still won't bar the application of the family purpose doctrine for purposes of ascribing liability to the parent.
So another way that a parent would be liable for either willful or negligent act of the child is if the parent was negligent in supervising the child. And so in a lot of states, a parent is liable for the child's negligent acts if the parent knows or has reason to know that it is necessary to control the child and the parent fails to take reasonable actions to do so. This is a legal theory called negligent supervision. And liability for negligent supervision is not limited to parents. It can extend to any custodial caregiver, grandparents, guardians. Whoever has custody or control of the child will also be liable if the child is just acting wild or is super negligent. If you know your child is a terrible driver, for example, or if you know your child has a habit of setting fires or something like that, and you know that there is a chance that he's going to cause damage to people, if you know or should know that there's a chance that he's going to cause damage to people, it is incumbent upon the guardian to make sure that doesn't happen.
And I think your point about guardianship is really important, because in most of these statutes, that is the case, that mm-hmm. all these statutes that we've talked about previously, that it's not just parents, it's parents or legal guardians.
Yep. And of course, this is all going to be subject to whether or not the child of the parent is considered a minor under the state's law, as far as if it's under 17, if it's under 18.
So. In addition to the age, also, there's the issue of emancipation. So once a minor has been emancipated, typically these parental liability statutes no longer apply. The negligent supervision statutes are so interesting because they don't all, but often they carry that requirement that the parent knew or should have known of the child's propensity for harmful conduct. Mm-hmm. So like you mentioned, if you've got a kid who's constantly setting fires or a teenager who is consistently driving drunk, and then the parent furnishes a car to that teenager, then I think that you could have a negligent supervision argument there.
Yeah.
That's a useful argument to have in a state that does not recognize other types of parental liability, such as family car, family purpose, things like that.
For example, California has a negligent supervision statute that says that parents would be responsible if the parent has knowledge of the child's potential for misconduct and fails to take reasonable steps to prevent such misconduct. And to use the example that you used, when a child, let's say it has a DUI conviction, if the state doesn't take the driver's license and there is a sponsorship statute, that would be a good time for the parent to go ahead and yank that driver's license.
Yes, it would. And in California, there is a sponsorship statute.
There
so, right, those two will play into each other very nicely. Mm-hmm. If you're in a jurisdiction that doesn't recognize parental liability for operation of motor vehicles or sponsorship statutes or family car doctrines, another alternative that you can try when you have a tortfeasor who is a minor is the dangerous instrumentality doctrine. Now, I want to note that this is one of those legal terms of art that is applied in two fairly different ways. One way that we hear dangerous instrumentality doctrine is when we're talking about the evolution of the attractive nuisance theory, where a dangerous instrumentality creates strict liability on the child's behalf. In other words, if you have something that's a dangerous instrumentality or an attractive nuisance and a child is drawn to it and they injure themselves, then the owner of that attractive nuisance or dangerous instrumentality, there's some strict liability on that owner. That is not what we're talking about with regard to this. That's a concept that's for the benefit of the child, to protect the child. Mm-hmm. Instead, we're talking about dangerous instrumentality doctrine as it pertains to one who authorizes and permits an instrumentality that is peculiarly dangerous in its operation to be used by another person, say on a public highway. That is how Florida describes it. It's limited to use on a public highway. That person is liable in damages for injuries to third persons caused by the negligent operation of the instrumentality on the highway. So this kind of gets into negligent maintenance of a vehicle, things like that. And so this is another way that you could get the owner of the vehicle to be liable for the operation of that vehicle by a person who could be a child, even if you don't have a parental liability statute.
Going along with dangerous instrumentality, a lot of states have specific laws that apply only to firearms and whether or not a parent has a duty specifically to keep a firearm away from a child. And, you know, one of the most notoriously gun-friendly states is Texas. And there is a law on the books that makes it a misdemeanor offense when a child gains access to a firearm because of an adult fails to secure the firearm and leaves it in a place which he knows that a child could gain access. So this is a fairly common law, and of course, a child can easily harm someone else and cause the parent to be liable if the child finds a firearm that the parent has negligently left out.
Sure, absolutely. One of those pieces of legislation that really acts to protect both the children and the general public.
Correct. Absolutely.
Well, why don't we turn now, and we've talked about our different legal theories here. Why don't we talk about how they actually play out in subrogation and why we would apply these to try to get the maximum recovery out of one of these cases where the tortfeasor is a minor?
So since a homeowner or a renter's insurance usually includes both property and liability coverage for an adult, the wrongful acts of children or negligent supervision claims may be covered even if the act takes place away from the policyholder's home. This would be under the liability coverage. So these policies typically cover legal liability in the event that anyone suffers an injury while they're on the property, even if the injury was committed by another household member or the result of the negligence on part of the policyholder. Most courts have held in favor of extending coverage in cases where the policy language is vague. Courts in California, Texas, and Washington have held that a parent's homeowner's liability covers the vicarious liability of parents for intentional acts of their delinquent children. So if your child goes out and harms someone intentionally or commits acts of vandalism, say, and the parent has a negligent supervision charge against them, the homeowner's policy would kick in and cover the parent in that instance. And the reason they've done that is that the parent is entitled to coverage because he didn't participate in the intentional act of the child. Therefore, it was not a quote-unquote intentional act on the part of the parent. If it was an intentional act on the part of the parent, that would be a policy exclusion.
Ah, so, if the parent had directed the child to do this defacing or vandalism or arson.
Correct. Even though the parent and the child are both insureds under the policy, and one of those people actually did do something intentional, the court would create a distinction in the policy that separates the relationship between the insurance company and the parent and the insurance company and the child. So for the child, the act was intentional, but for the parent, the act was negligent, which would be covered. Ohio has reached the opposite conclusion and held that a homeowner's policy did not cover a father's statutory liability for damage inflicted by his son on the property of another person. The court reasoned, and I believe this is a fire case, arson. The court reasoned that although the liability may have been unexpected or accidental, the damage was not. So the parent was negligent, but the damage was intentionally done by the child. Therefore, the damage did not constitute an accident or occurrence within the meaning of the policy, and the exclusion applied. So there was no coverage. The Ohio court focused on the expected nature of damage as it is distinguished from the expected nature of liability. And I can see how you could go either way on this issue.
Another way that these statutes that we're talking about, the parental liability statutes, can help in terms of pursuing recoveries in a subrogation context is in terms of service. So oftentimes one of the problems that we have is that it's difficult to find a driver to serve him or her just by virtue of the fact that you might have limited information about the driver. Oftentimes we have much more information about the owner because we can find the Bureau of Motor Vehicles or Department of Motor Vehicles information with regard to the registration of the vehicle. Mm-hmm. So then we have a valid address, an up-to-date address for the owner, but maybe not the driver. So you can use these sponsorship statutes or parental liability statutes to ascribe liability to the owner of the vehicle or somebody else against whom you might have better information. And that way you can get them served. Once you get them served, then you have the ability to pursue their insurance. Otherwise, the insurance, even though it does cover the minor, doesn't necessarily have to respond or pay at all if you can't actually get to your judgment due to lack of service on the minor.
So that covers everything we have to say on parental liability in the United States. Do you have anything to add?
I do not. You're all experts now.
Everyone's an expert. It makes me think a lot about what's going to happen when my children get a little older. They're 8 and 6 at this point. You know, right now they're too small to really hurt anyone. But, you know, going forward, it's going to be fun.
Same.
It's going to be a lot of gray hairs.
We both have boys, and I feel like in addition to the extraordinarily high car insurance rates we're going to be paying in a few short years, now we get to worry about all of this as well.
Yeah.
Well, if you have questions or would like more information, if you want to suggest a future topic or refer a file, please feel free to email us at podcast@rathbonegroup.com.
Or visit our website, www.rathbonegroup.com.
If you're enjoying this podcast, we ask that you please subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you really like it, write a review.
Give us a 5-star rating. Why not?
Why not? It's free.
It's free to give us a 5-star rating.
We want to say thank you to Ralph DeSilvestro for composing and performing our intro and outro music, and ask you to join us again soon on Subrogation.